There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. And as I mentioned last hour, conversation, always good to talk to the Agricultural Commissioner, Rick Pate, on the show. And there's lots to talk about here. We're going to have a kind of a wide-ranging discussion on agriculture and the question about medical marijuana as well in the mix. Commissioner, thanks for your time. Thanks for being on with us.
Well, thanks, John. Good to be with you again.
Good to have you back. So let's, first of all, we'll talk a little cotton as we get started here, because it's made some stories around the state. I can see it. People who farm right next to us, you know, the cotton, its situation for being waterlogged, and heck, even water laying in peanut fields. What's going on around the state of Alabama with those producers?
Well, you know, it's almost like people, I get asked that question a lot, but it's difficult to answer, and I'm going to tell you why, because everybody's being impacted differently. Yeah, I've seen the fields. I was in Headland Saturday, and yeah, you see some water standing in the field. But overall, we've probably got pretty good crops this year, especially if we can get some harvested. And of course, we're supposed to have 4 or 5 good days here. But yeah, it's sort of like when a tornado comes through. To those it goes over, it's devastating, and then you can be a mile away and not have any damage. So we've certainly had some people, farmers impacted, and all across the board, corn, cotton, peanuts, soybeans, and then we've had some people that are telling us they're just going to have a bumper crop. So, you know, it's hard unless you tell me an individual farmer, an individual location, an individual crop to tell you, you know, I think overall we're still going to do well this year.
That's good news. I think poultry is our number one export, but for row crop, what's number one for us? Is it cotton?
Probably is cotton, yeah, among those. But there's, yeah, it's such a dramatic drop from poultry. Really got timber up here, and then poultry sort of suck it behind it, and then there's a pretty good drop, so you get to all our other commodities, beef and our row crops.
I'm going to talk about another crop in the mix here as well. You and I had talked about in the past when this hemp farming was starting. And so first of all, kind of set the stage, Commissioner, like hemp farming, because we're going to get in the medical marijuana discussion. But first, hemp farming in Alabama, what are they doing with the hemp? How much do we grow? Who gets to grow it?
Well, let's see. Start off with who gets to grow it. Really, it's the kind of thing that really almost anybody that can meet the requirements for it can grow it. There's no limit like there will be with medical cannabis about the number of growers. No limit really on the number of acres you can grow. And so we've seen it, and I guess this is our fourth year, I think, you know, sort of go up and up. And last year, not the current year, but the year before was probably our biggest year. We had well over 400 people growing it with licenses. And then it did drop some this year to, you know, close to half of that. And the problem continues to be, there's no doubt that hemp fiber has value. It's sort of the chicken and the egg, you know. You got to get enough fiber out there to where a larger industry would start to consider using it in water bottles or you know, dashboards of cars. I mean, everybody wants biodegradable products used as opposed to plastics and those kind of things. And then, of course, the CBD oil kind of sort of spiked, and it's a supply and demand thing. I think that we probably had too much out there a year or two ago, and now with fewer people growing it, maybe it'll go back up.
You think we end up in that world like somebody forecasting whether they're going to go corn or beans, you know, looking at what input costs are versus the next year's possible profit?
Well, I think, yeah, a lot of farmers look at it like that. Of course, hemp certainly hadn't consistently shown it could be profitable. A lot of people put a few acres in or 5 or 10 acres and just to see. Of course, it's such a labor-intensive product. We've had a few people that try to create some things to harvest it with. And but, you know, there's really, since it's been illegal for so long, there's no registration for any herbicides or pesticides or anything to be sprayed on it. So it can be pretty labor intensive.
Now, those hemp farmers, can they sell to a, like you talked about the market, is it an out-of-state market or do they have to keep it in the state? Any rules like that or is it like any other commodity?
There are no rules like that. Yeah, okay. You're right. We don't, the first year, it was so confusing. We tried to regulate it or thought we had to regulate it even as it was being sold. We met with the Attorney General and Aaliyah and said that was just possible for us because there was so much that came into Alabama from out of state and went ours that went out of state. So we just follow it till it goes to a processor. And then, you know, we don't try to track what happened to it after it.
Because
it's a consumable or it's processed.
But it's, I've heard, because people have said to me before, well, that's what people are just going to grow marijuana there, right? Cannabis there and pretend it's hemp. But there's systems in the state to prevent that.
Oh, no, that's not going to happen. Yeah, I mean, not saying nobody ever got away with anything. Cause we know they have. But, yeah, we have to have the GPS and we coordinate with Aaliyah where our fields are. And so when they do their flyovers, you know, that's one of the pieces of information they have. And, yeah, and of course, we have to, if people aren't aware, for anybody to harvest hemp, we have to come sample it. And we take a random sample around the fields, and then we bring it back. We've got a really top-notch food and drug lab at our building. And so we have to test it for THC, and it has to be below 0.3. And so that would be low enough that it wouldn't suit somebody that wanted to smoke marijuana because it wouldn't get them high.
Okay, so now with that being said, kind of setting the background there on the hemp, now we got the questions going forward coming off of the legislation here for medical marijuana. From the Ag Commission's perspective, what do we need to know? I mean, will these be Alabama farmers?
Yeah, I'm going to use their term. I'm going to call it medical cannabis.
Medical cannabis.
I don't know why they make that distinction, but it makes it easier for us.
Okay.
So the bill was one of those that got passed at the last minute, and everybody knew there were a lot of problems with it, a lot of contradictions, and so they've appointed, those who don't know now, they've appointed the 12-member voting commission that's overseeing it. They've hired, actually, John McMillan, who was the current state treasurer who had been agriculture commissioner for me, and he took three of his staff that actually had been here at the Department of Ag and went with him to Department of Treasury. And so now they're, since October 1st, they're on board, and I think you're going to see things start happening a little bit. But we've been very adamant that we don't want the Department of Ag to have any role. There's actually the law calls for there to be four integrators, and so by integrator they mean companies that have pharmacies, they process it and they grow it. They do have the whole chain, supply chain, and then there's the law allows for 12 growers in addition to those four integrators. And so we just think that there's going to be a lot of politics and as far as who's awarded those licenses, and we just didn't feel like that was our role. That commission has that authority, and so we want them to select who gets. We'll have some role, we know, because we did a pretty dang good job with hemp as far as regulating it and checking on its growth and how it was being handled and then testing it. But, you know, obviously this is a completely different animal because it had been classified as a federal legal drug. So it'll have a whole different level of security attached to it. So we know we'll have some role. We don't know what that role, but the role we know we do not want at the Department of Ag is to select who those growers will be.
Yeah.
But now who will get those 12 licenses? That's what John, Commissioner McMillan and them are charged with, and that 12-member commission is writing those rules, who can apply. I know you've got to have be a resident of Alabama for 5 years or some, that you've got to have been a farmer to have been. And so there's stuff, and there's some geographical distribution they want. Obviously, they want a certain percentage to minorities and to make sure it's reflective of citizens of Alabama. So all of that will have to be worked out. But I think it's going to be pretty competitive because, you know, whatever objective standards they write, I feel like there's more than 12 people that probably will meet that standard. And then once they do, then what are you going to have a lottery among those? Or are you going to flip a coin? I don't know. I don't want any role in that. They could work that out. But we know in Florida when they started it, it's a whole thing, the kind of thing that meant itself to people feeling or not smelling right or people feeling like something didn't go down right. And so that brings lawsuits, and that's another reason we don't want to roll. Is I don't have time to be defending lawsuits every day or don't want to do that. That wasn't what I ran for this office to do. So anyway, I think they're off to a good start. I think people are way too optimistic how fast they think that somebody's going to be growing medical cannabis because it's just a lot of rules. I mean, they're starting off with nothing, really. Then they've got to get back to the legislature. And so I don't know if they're going to be able to pick it up while they're in a special session on redistricting. So that means it'll wait till January. And then when you open it up, I guess, and people can start adding new amendments or new changes. So I'm not a legislator. I don't know all the ins and outs of that. But anyway, there's a lot still got to be done. But I'm sure Commissioner McMillan and other smart people will work that out.
Yeah, I'm going to try to get a discussion with him as well about this because it's a lot of stuff you brought up is very interesting. Like, the fact that there will absolutely, I agree, be more than 12 people that fit, you know, whatever the RFP is for this, right, that'll fit that. Then how do you pick the person who gets a license versus somebody else? I think, like on NRCS stuff and all that, when you get scored on something, I wonder if it'll be that. You know, there's probably going to be more than 12 people that duplicate on score, too. So I don't know how you choose that. You're saying, thank goodness, it's not in the Department of Ag to make that discussion or that decision.
Well, it's not for sure not here yet, but that's what everybody seems to agree, that, yeah, we're not trained, and that's not our role. And, yeah, so I hope that follows through. You know, the legislature can do anything. They couldn't, you know, put it at our department. But, yeah, they seem to agree, and the commission seems to agree, and that, yeah, it doesn't belong here. So hopefully they'll do that. To me, that's their job. I mean, I would say that. Whoever wants to grow it needs to submit those applications to the Commissioner McMillan, and he needs to forward that information on to that 12-member commission. And they're all grown-ups and put in those positions to make those tough decisions.
If you're just joining us, talking to Agriculture Commissioner Rick Pate, some texts coming in here with questions. Phil asked here about the Alabama crop export delays that are happening right now at the ports. What do you know about that?
Well, you know, and I hadn't really heard that so much at the Port of Mobile, and so that would be news. I'm like you. I mean, I watch the news, and I know we're having those issues. I haven't heard that it's impacted any of our commodity prices at this point, but yeah, I think we're having some issues with a lot of transportation, distribution, including the port. But I don't know of anything that's really happening at the Port of Mobile.
All right. We're going to run to a quick break and come right back. More with Ag Commissioner Rick Pate right here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, get right back to it. Ag Commissioner Rick Pate, our guest. And Commissioner, I want to talk about this program. We had mentioned in the past, that farm-to-school program. Can you explain that to Alabamians here? What is the program? How's it working?
Well, of course, when I first got in, I realized we needed some way to identify local food. And so we created Sweet Grown Alabama brand, and that was working well. But I started looking at the school system, just went by it. Local food, and it's pretty much across the board. And so we had heard about a program, and I think it was in Minnesota somewhere, where they had got reimbursed the school a little bit when they fed local food. And so we got the legislature in last year, the year we just completed, to give us $120,000, and we had reimbursed the school system a quarter for every time they fed a local product to the school system. And that doesn't sound like much. They feed thousands of meals, and of course they don't get but $1.37 a plate, so pretty big, pretty nice inducement to them. And so we really had some school systems start to take advantage of it, and it just made so much sense. I mean, we had Chilton County school system not serving peaches from Chilton County because they could buy them cheaper from Mexico, or school wow. system in North Alabama using California tomatoes, and they had plenty of tomatoes in that area. So it's really been great, and your legislators down there were really supportive. Senator Albritton, Sessions, Jack Williams have all been great, and we appreciate it. But we actually asked $200,000 this coming year, and so we got that, and so we're going to try to even expand it, because we probably, with the amount of money we had, didn't probably touch half or even probably a third of the school system. So now hopefully we'll have the resources to expand it.
That Chilton County peaches probably is the best emblem there, that the kids there weren't getting their local produce. That's I mean, I think it probably shocks a lot of people, you know, that you wouldn't. I mean, it seems like it makes sense to get the local producers to supply the schools.
Well, yeah, and you had down in Slocum, the tomatoes, or Coleman or Baldwin County sweet potatoes. And yeah, there's just a lot of stuff we're growing, and we really need to be encouraging more of that. We saw that it was COVID. We had the resiliency in our agricultural system to, even though we might have had a few shortages, but we pretty much never had to call another country and say, hey, we're running out of food. We need some help feeding our people. So if we want to maintain that capability, and so we're actively trying to grow our local vegetables and fruits.
Do you see that? I mean, it seems like if there was a steady business from a school system, that would help local producers, you know, keep more land in crops. You know what I'm saying? If you had to, yeah, I mean, that's pretty steady business.
Well, right, yeah. Sweet corn, there's just a lot of stuff. And the thing is, it helps a lot of small farms. It doesn't take a lot of acres to grow sweet potatoes or to grow tomatoes or pickles, I mean, the cucumbers. So, yeah, you can keep people maybe in rural communities that otherwise would have to be moving into larger cities to find employment.
That's a good program. I can't wait to get the next update on this, so please keep us in the loop.
Absolutely, yeah. We're so pleased that they've seen value in what we did last year and have agreed to continue to fund it. We're going to actually back it down this year. They did such a good job. We're going to only give them 20 cents. But this year, we're going to let them, if they serve two local things, they actually can get 40 cents. So anyway, we'll see how that does. We're going to put a cap. We had one school system that really fell in love with it and probably bought about close to $30,000 in there. We didn't mean for that. We'll probably put a $20,000 cap, the most that any one school system could get. So. Oh. But yeah, it's working well.
And Commissioner Rick Pate, as always, a pleasure talking with you, and we'll get you back on the show soon.
right, John. Appreciate y'all. Have a great day.
Will do. All right. Coming right back. More Midday Mobile right here on FM Talk 106.5.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Segment of the show brought to you by Stamps.com. You know the hustle of running a small business, right? A person of many hats? Well, if you've got a small business, you know there's nothing more valuable than your time. So stop wasting it on trips to the post office. Stamps.com makes it easy to mail and ship right from your computer. Since 1998, Stamps.com has been an indispensable tool for nearly 1 million businesses. Stamps.com brings the services of the U.S. Postal Service and UPS right to your computer. And that's what we do here. All you need is a computer and a printer. No special supplies or equipment, and within minutes, you're up and running, printing official U.S. postage for any letter, any package, anywhere you want to send it. And you'll get exclusive discounts on postage and shipping from the Postal Service and UPS. And once your mail is ready, just schedule a pickup or drop it off in the mailbox like we do here. No lines, no wasted time. So do this. Save time and money with Stamps.com. There's no risk as well. When you use my promo code Sean, S-E-A-N, my first name, you'll get a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and enter in Sean, S-E-A-N. It's Stamps.com, promo code Sean, Stamps.com. Never go to the post office again. All right, a lot of great text here, too, from our discussion from last hour. And this is just coming off the September jobs report. And we're, you know, they were expecting 700,000 to 800,000 new jobs added. And I think we ended up at 194,000. And the question was, you know, what's happening out there? Why aren't people going back to work as you take away these incentives not to work? Why aren't they going back to work? The story here at Fox News or Fox Business had non-farm payrolls increased by 194,000 workers in September as the unemployment rate fell to 4.8%. Economists surveyed were expected the addition of 500,000 new jobs and the unemployment rate to slip to 5.1%. The job gains in August were revised up to 366,000 from 235,000. September report was the first since the $300 per week in supplemental unemployment benefits expired on September 5th. Economists are still assessing the impact of the child tax credit, which pays families up to $3,600 per year per child. Also, well, it depends on the age of the children, but also having an impact going forward will be mandatory vaccine requirements being enforced by a growing number of companies. It's interesting if you look and you start breaking out the different sectors, like some sectors have a lot less people going back to work than others, you know, and leisure and hospitality and I think food service and those have been tough. And you can see that by just driving around town, right? All right. This texter says, unnamed texter, hey, y'all give yourself a nickname or give me your first name or both names or whatever. I just like it more when I can address somebody by something other than unnamed texter. This unnamed texter says, I don't think there's one answer as to why people haven't gone back to work. There are many different scenarios that led to each person being unemployed. I think a fair amount of job shortages are positions that many don't see as a career. I agree with you there. These were considered non-essential in the early days of the pandemic, so the people that filled those jobs had to find something else. They had no idea when they would even be allowed back to work. They had no idea when they would be allowed back to work on those positions again, so it's not hard to believe that many didn't wait if they found essential jobs, and it's probable that the pay and benefits were better, so why would they go back to the once-deemed non-essential job again? Many different scenarios, and there's not just one answer to explain them all. Personally, I don't think we'll ever be back to pre-pandemic job situations. The only thing that's for sure is that nothing is for sure. that's for sure on that. John, why in the hell is a state giving only 12 medical marijuana licenses. It should be available to anyone who qualifies. John. You know, we're the pro-business state of Alabama, right? This goes back to my dissent over the gambling legislation. It was not over gambling. I'm not a gambler, but I don't. If people want to vote to have lottery and gaming, that's fine. I'm cool. My beef was why we were carving out this duopoly to run gaming in the state of Alabama. Remember? I mean, it wasn't the fact that they were gambling. I thought they should offer licenses in the state of Alabama, whatever it costs. I don't know. I'm just throwing numbers out here. I don't know it's $2 million a year to buy the license, and then it's 10% of the profits or whatever. And you agree, and then if you want to do that and build your own place and compete, but no, it's impossible to do that in Alabama. So we have a duopoly situation that they're still debating. Same thing here on this medical side. I agree with you, John. If you could show that, I mean, if they want to set the levels of security and all these things very high, that's fine. But anybody who meets that, shouldn't they be able to compete in the marketplace? But it's not. It's 12 licenses will be given out. And you're going to be scored on different things. I like the fact that if we're going to do it inside the state, it's state producers. Although it's, once again, that's picking winners. But you have to be in the state. I think it said 5 years. You have to have been farming for a couple years, which I don't know. There's plenty of people I know that have moved to places where they can grow marijuana that were not farmers. I know these people, they were whatever before, and they figured out how to do it. And then you have to check off another couple boxes. But even with that being said, Ag Commissioner Pate said there's going to be more than 12 people that fit that bill. So how do you choose which one gets it? I mean, and a lot of times with government programs and some of the farm programs and more like the NRCS and different ones, they score it. They have money to apply to whatever this is. It's Kogan eradication. It's whatever, incentivizing planting longleaves, gopher tortoise initiative, whatever it is. They have it and people apply, and then you're scored by what area you're in. Is that area of concern? How much of whatever they're trying to do is there? Different things. And then they, you know, you get a score, and then the people with the highest scores get the grants until there's no more money. And then they start over again the next year. But in this case, I mean, it seems like you're going to have a lot of people that will have their scores will be even. They're a lot more than 12. And how do they decide? That's where the politics comes in on this, right? And you could hear there's some good truth there to the voice of Ag Commissioner Rick Pate basically saying, we don't want any part of it. He's like, I'm glad there's a different commission that John McMillan will be heading, and now we're trying to get him on the show. They'll be making those decisions. I mean, you heard him, I think, three or four different times saying, we don't want any part of that. Because how do you decide that? Isn't that a situation where you go, man, a little nudge over the line may be a big deal for one person to be able to grow medical cannabis, and two people that were equally qualified, one person gets it, one person doesn't. I don't have answers for it, but we're going to keep digging on that. Listen now. Okay. There's been a few of these. I'll go ahead and take my lick right now. There's a few of these sections. Yes. Yes, Bama lost Saturday night. Yes, I realize that. How I realize that. And yes, I realize the same Texas A&M that lost to Arkansas beat Alabama. I do realize that. I'm not going to say there's the excuse machines out there. Listen, A&M played a great game and Alabama didn't. I mean, that's straight up. A&M just beat Alabama. I mean, there's not. I see you go on Twitter and there's all this. Oh, well, and then there was this call and that. Nah. Alabama lost. So, yeah, y'all get your digs in. Chuck says, Sean, in reference to farm incentives, Pete Golding should be fired by Nick Saban. They got beaten. That's just no spin machine for me. I watched that and I said, well, that sucks, doesn't it? Yep. All right. So it is. I can't wait to hear Paul Feinbaum talking with Dan and Dalton on Friday about this. It's going to be, I'm popping popcorn right now for it. All right, coming right back. It's time for a checkup. Dr. Case from Southern Cancer Center joins us.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Time for a checkup. And joining us, Dr. Brittany Case with Southern Cancer Center. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, I want to talk about because we know the crew at Southern Cancer Center, and I want to talk more about what y'all do. But your journey to now be with this great group at Southern Cancer Center. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. So I'm an Alabama girl, born and raised. So I'm from over close to Dothan Enterprise.
The Wiregrass.
Yeah. That's right. So I'm from Kinston, Alabama, which no one ever knows. So Enterprise Dothan is usually the closest place anyone's ever heard of.
Right.
So I grew up there. I did my undergrad at Troy and then med school at UAB in Birmingham. And then I was here in Mobile for 4 years. So I did my internal medicine residency at South. Stayed on and did a chief year here, and then went up to Jackson, Mississippi for 3 years, and that's where I did my hematology and oncology fellowship. So now we're back here.
Wow. And I mean, what y'all do in school like people live a lifetime in the period of time you're in school.
That's right.
No, that's good.
People have started jobs, quit jobs, you know.
right. By the time you're like, oh, and now I'm finished with school. But you talk about hematology too. Is that blood or...
Right. So really we train. So it's a 3-year training program and you study both hematology and oncology. So, of course, oncology is more of like the solid tumor malignancies, breast cancer, colon cancer and things like that. Hematology, there's both benign and malignant hematology. So malignant hematology is more like leukemias, lymphomas and things like that.
Okay, that's...
And then benign hematology would be, you know, your anemias, you know, any of your lab work on your, you know, blood counts that are abnormal and things like that.
So, yeah, I never thought about that when you talk about leukemia or something like that. That is, I mean, but it's not regular oncology because it's in the blood.
Right. So it's really, you know, worked up and taken care of a lot differently than the solid tumors.
So you've studied both.
Correct.
Let's talk about this. I'm talking to people right now in the process that has gotten you to Southern Cancer Center and the process that might get them to Southern Cancer Center, right? So when you've got a concerning symptom, and you can help me understand what those concerning symptoms, where do you start with this?
Sure. So, you know, the concerning symptoms, depending on what type of cancer it is, you know, the symptoms can be highly variable. But, you know, in general, anything that's new that you're concerned about, I think is never a bad idea, you know, to go check in with your primary care physician about. So, you know, new unexplained weight loss, night sweats, fatigue that's out of the ordinary for you. I always tell people bumps or blood anywhere they shouldn't be. So bumps that come out of nowhere that, you know, you can't explain, blood in your stool, blood in your urine, things like that. But, you know, really anything that you notice, you know, this is not right for me, then I think your primary care is probably the best place to start for that. So those are going to be the doctors that know you the best. You know, they follow you over time. And so, you know, you go to them and they can usually initiate the workup that you'll need and then send you, you know, to a subspecialist or to oncology when that time's appropriate.
You know, but there's a kind of a hurdle to overcome there. What you said before we get to you at Southern Cancer Center, but with their primary care, it's a lot of times we don't want to say like, yeah, I'm fine.
Right.
I'm fine. You know, it's just a kind of a human nature. It's not good for us, but we do it.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, you know, some things, you know, little symptoms that may come up, you know, may come and go and, you know, then you never think anything else about it. But if it's something that's persistent, you know, I think people have a very good sense of their own body and, you know, knowing when something's not right. And so I don't think it's ever a bad idea, you know, to just go in and say, hey, this may be nothing. And if so, that's great. But let's not, you know, get behind the eight ball on anything. So.
So our primary care physician sees something. Okay, this is something we need to get looked at. So walk us through the steps. I walk in the front door, kind of, you know, at Southern Cancer Center. What's it like? What happens?
Yeah. So, you know, really a patient will not come to see us until they have a true cancer diagnosis for the most part. So, you know, initially you'll likely go to your primary care physician and depending on what your symptom is, they'll order the appropriate, you know, lab work and imaging studies. So, you know, if you're having fatigue or you know, night sweats and things like that, then they're most likely going to get some basic lab work on you, look at your blood counts. And, you know, if you have a lump, bump, something somewhere, then usually an image is going to be part of your workup. So that could be an ultrasound, an MRI, a CT scan. And usually your primary care is going to be the person to order those images. And then if there's something abnormal on them, then they'll likely refer you to a subspecialist for a biopsy. So, you know, if you're having blood in your stool, you go see your primary care physician, then they'll probably send you to, you know, a gastroenterologist and have a colonoscopy, and you can have a biopsy, you know, during your colonoscopy. If you're, you know, a longtime smoker, maybe you have a cough that's changed, or now you're coughing up blood or something, then, you know, they'll probably order chest x-ray or CT of your chest. And if there's something abnormal there, then send you, you know, to a pulmonologist to have a biopsy done. So really, you know, the main thing that we need for a cancer diagnosis, for a definitive diagnosis, is tissue. And so, you know, a subspecialist in general will help us get the tissue that we need. And then a pathologist will look at that and say, yes, this is cancer. And that's really when the patient winds up at, you know, in our office.
So when people come to see you, Dr. Case, they've gotten the news they've got cancer.
Most often. Now, of course, we do see people for, you know, those benign hematology issues as well. So, you know, iron deficiency anemia and things like that is always scary for patients to land in our office, you know, because mm-hmm. there is the word cancer, you know, in the name of our building. But, you know, it's not always, you know, for cancer that patients get referred to us. But, you know, sometimes we'll even get involved in a patient's workup if there's a high suspicion that they have a malignancy. You know, sometimes the, you know, your primary care physician may send you to us before the biopsy. Maybe
kind of getting started early with
right.
this.
So Okay. Maybe there's a couple of, you know, maybe you get a CT scan and there's a couple of different areas of concern, and your primary care physician wants to know, what do you think is the best thing to biopsy? Mm-hmm. You know, what would you go after? And so sometimes we'll get involved. You know, we're happy to help, you know, earlier on in the process too, if you know, primary care feels like our input's needed at that point.
That's good. That, because time is of the essence, not trying to be cliche, but
right.
Dr. Case, in your world, it is truly of the essence.
That's right.
All right. So we get that. We got the confirmation of the cancer. Now, do we continue to do testing, and do we get assigned, like, if I see you, are you going to be my physician through it, or are there going to be several? Or how does it work?
Yeah. So the thing I really love about the field of oncology is it's a team-based approach, and, you know, it's very much multidisciplinary. So what patients don't see a lot of the times is behind the scenes, you know, there are a lot of us convening to talk about their particular case. And so, you know, we know that all cancers are different, and even within, you know, colon cancer, there are a lot of different nuances that help us determine how exactly we're going to treat you. And so once you get a diagnosis, you know, we very often will discuss the patient's case, you know, in our tumor boards. And that would include, you know, us as medical oncologists, our radiation oncologists, surgeons, radiology, pathology. And so we all sit down and say, you know, this is the situation with this patient. How do we think is the best way to go about treating them? And then we decide who all is going to be involved, you know, in that patient's care.
So you have a whole suite of people at Southern Cancer Center looking at this individual case.
Right.
I mean, do you ever, just an aside, do you ever have that moment where, you know, one physician's bringing something in, or look at, and then somebody else goes, wait a second, I've seen something like this before, or I have some experience with this?
Yes, absolutely. Especially, you know, for maybe the more rare cancer types mm-hmm. and things like that. I mean, you know, I've just recently started, you know, in my career as an oncologist, and I've already had a couple of cases where I said, you know, this is something that's not very common. And so, you know, I'll take that to tumor board, and it's nice to get other people's input, you know, people who are more seasoned at mm-hmm. this than I am, and say, you know, this is what I was thinking, you know, tell me what you would do. And, you know, then we can all kind of come up with what we think is the best thing to do for the patient.
Now, I'm glad you said that, Dr. Case, because I mean, people would think, okay, Dr. Case or Dr. whomever is my physician, not knowing that there's this, you know, think tank mm-hmm. behind it with looking at it.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think that's the best thing that we can do for patient care, because every case is a little bit different. And so, you know, there are so many people that will be involved in a patient's care that it's important for us to make sure that we're all on the same page. And it's important, you know, for the patients as well, that we kind of come to them with a good plan of action, you know, that we've all put together, You know, so that we're all on the same page and taking care of the patient.
This is great. And next time I get you back, we got to talk about the different kinds of cancers you're seeing out there and different stages too. Can we do that one?
Yeah, that sounds great.
All right. Dr. Case, I appreciate your time and I can't wait to see you again.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much.